the chaotic assault on the inhabitants of Shechem that Levi and Simeon instigated convinced Jacob that the future of his household in Canaan was doomed. The language that he used was very vivid. You have made me to stink among the inhabitants of the land. He was sure that the forces of all the cities around the area would come together and overwhelm easily any defense that Jacob and his sons and their servants could mount. The question that Jacob's sons posed at the end of chapter 34 seemed to Jacob to be the end of his efforts to carve out a peaceful, prosperous place for his family in the very heart of Canaan. But that question that brings chapter 34 to such an apparently ominous end yields to the voice of God in the very next sentence. In the last verse of the previous chapter, we read, "And they said," in the opening words of chapter 35, we read, "And God said," "they said," "God said." Now at the beginning of chapter 34, Jacob was not ready to hear what God had to say. But at the beginning of chapter 35, he was ready. At the moment when Jacob's prospects seemed to be blackest, the voice of God came again to his soul and brought him real refreshment. Jacob found comfort again, as he had before, in the reality that in all the calamities, God did not depart from his servant or from the cause of Jacob's family. In fact, God's voice at the opening of this chapter urged Jacob to resume, to continue his journey back to his father's home. God urged him particularly to get back to Bethel, to the place where that famous meeting occurred nearly 30 years before. Jacob and his family had become somewhat comfortable in their little enclave outside the walls of Shechem. That place, that camp, although it seemed it was a little more permanent than that, that place of habitation became a symbol as well of their spiritual complacency. Life was going on, and they felt no urgency to continue making progress spiritually. To be back in Canaan, to be back in the land that God had promised to Abraham and to Isaac, was, it seems, sufficient. And so, the members of Jacob's family continued with a halfway religion. Oh, they had an altar that Jacob erected. They had a form of worship. But we read that there was still a toleration for the various false gods that Leah, and particularly Rachel, and others worshipped in the old country. The voice of God changed all those expectations and made Jacob realize that the reason for all the calamities was that his family was living without reference to the reality of the altar of the atoning sacrifice. They had to get back to Bethel, to the house of God. But Jacob understood and made it plain that they could not simply change their physical location. It was not simply a matter of packing everything up and saying, well, let's get back there because we have nice memories from there. Jacob made it plain they had to make the break with the old life. And they had to devote themselves entirely to following the one true God. Even then, as they would learn, they would discover no shortage of trials and no lack of opposition to their journey. The story of Jacob's life is one of the grace of God in the life of a sinner. In this passage, that grace reasserts itself, and the journey resumes. Here we find set before us grace's powerful effects. Grace's powerful effects. It became painfully obvious, although it took a while, that the disasters of chapter 34 sprang from the fatal reliance on human reason and human ambition, and with a healthy mixture of human greed thrown in on the side. But God began to work his will in the life of Jacob again. And Jacob began to wake up. He began to realize that there were things he was tolerating in his household that were going to have to change. He knew they could not go back to Bethel in the condition in which they were. Now, it's interesting, is it not, that the Lord, in verse 1, did not say to Jacob, Jacob, you have people there that are worshiping false gods. They need to get rid of them. The Lord didn't say that. The Lord just said to Jacob, Jacob, you need to get back to Bethel. You need to get back to the altar that you made when I appeared to you there. And Jacob realized that all the life they had spent, all the years they had spent in Shechem, they had been engaged in a halfway religion. He was a man in whom the grace of God was working. And Jacob knew what had to happen. He knew that they couldn't go back to Bethel with the images of their false gods hanging about their necks like so many albatrosses. Now there's a message here for those who are trying to make their way to heaven by maintaining a mere attachment to the people of God. It will never be sufficient. Some people think if I can just stay reasonably close to the church and to the people who are true believers in the church, then their grace will spill over to me. But the message is that will never happen. So it's time for you, if that's your case, to abandon that approach. It's time for you to profess your faith in Christ, to give up your own efforts, to resign your own merit as a ground for your confidence. And there's a message here as well for those who profess to be believers in Christ, but who think that they can make adequate spiritual progress while they are still camped at Shechem, in the place of compromise, while they still cling to their old thoughts and their old allegiances to the world around them. And the message is, the effects of grace cannot be contained. The effects of grace foster the atmosphere in which the compromises with the world must be identified and abandoned. Now, there are four indicators of these powerful effects in our passage today. The first of them is divine intervention in life. Divine intervention in life. The single greatest proof of God's grace is that He does not leave His people to wallow in their own devices. Now, that ought to encourage you, if nothing else does, in this whole message. Because you know that there have been times, and maybe you're there now, you know there have been times when you have been content simply to drift along through life, depending upon your own reasoning, your own devices, but God has not left you there. God has intervened. God has disturbed you. Indeed, any time we hear these words with which this chapter begins, "And God said," we must rejoice in the comforting thought that God knows what we need to hear. And He knows how to deliver His people out of their distress. And as we find it here, it's not a message that comforts us in the middle of our halfwayness. It's not a message that comes along and says, "Well, you know, you're doing pretty well. Just do a little better. Just do a little better. Do a little more." Today, the way counselors deal with people, you would think that that is how God operates. But God came to Jacob and He said, "Jacob, you need to get out of this place. Whatever that means, Jacob, get out of this place. Get back to Bethel." Now, Jacob was convinced when this voice of God came that things couldn't have been any worse. He was angry with his sons, as well he should have been, but he should have been as angry with himself for what had taken place. He felt the emotions of embarrassment. He was ashamed that they had executed this agreement with the inhabitants of Shechem, and that here the inhabitants of Shechem had gone to carry out their part of the bargain, as it were, and in the midst of that, his sons went in and slaughtered them all. He was embarrassed that he had no ability to control his sons. And he was also afraid about what the result of these awful circumstances would be. So as far as Jacob was concerned, things were really bad. This was about as low as he could be, so he thought. And then God spoke to him. And there may have been times in your life, and maybe you're there now, where you think it can't get any worse than this. And it's then that God's voice is heard. God gave Jacob clear direction that cut through the fog of Jacob's reasoning. It was a call to him to get up and to get back to the house of God. And what was the significance of that place? It was the place of the ladder. It was the place where Jacob had the dream. This was 30 years before, when he was running away from Esau. He had the dream of the ladder set up on the earth whose top reached to heaven. And when we considered that part of Jacob's life, we saw the true significance of it. It was a messianic revelation to Jacob, because Jesus Christ likened himself to that ladder. So Jacob had received a vision of Messiah, of the mediator. And now God was saying, you need to get back there. It is when the days are darkest that this call rings in our souls. Let's look back a few pages to chapter 28. Chapter 28 and verse 20. And Jacob vowed a vow, saying, if God will be with me, and will keep me in this way that I go, and will give me bread to eat, and raiment to put on, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then shall the Lord be my God, and this stone which I have set up for a pillar shall be God's house. And of all that thou shalt give me, I will surely give the tenth unto thee. God said, Jacob, it's time to go back, because Jacob had to say on that occasion, the Lord was in this place and I did not know it. But when he came to realize it, he knew that God's hand was upon him. He had no idea about what lay before him, all the twists and turns of the years at Laban's household. But he knew that God would be with him. God reminded Jacob in this verse of that history. He reminded him of how tenuous the situation appeared when Jacob was at Bethel before. You remember that, Jacob? You were using a stone for your pillow. You had no tent. You were just lying out in the open on the ground. You didn't have herds of livestock. You didn't have flocks of sheep. You were just running away, thinking that at any moment your brother would catch up to you and dispatch you for the deceptions that you had perpetrated upon your father. Remember that situation, Jacob. Now you're in a situation that seems just as tenuous. This is the message that God was conveying to him. But God was saying, get back to Bethel, get back to the place where Messiah appears, get back to the place of the mediator, get back to the place where you recognize that you cannot of yourself approach unto God. What a revelation that Jacob received. Here is one of the powerful effects of grace. God intervenes. God stops his people. When things appear that they can't be any worse, God arrests them and he gives them the direction that they need. And then something happened. And that's the second effect of this grace, sanctification's progress. And we find it set before us in verses 2 and 4. Jacob realized that things had to change. Now, Jacob could remember, and it had been by this time probably about 10 years since it had happened, an ugly confrontation with Laban. If you turn back a few pages to chapter 31, chapter 31, and now let us read beginning at verse 30. And now, though thou wouldest needs be gone, because thou sore longest after thy father's house, yet wherefore hast thou stolen my gods? And notice what Jacob said in verse 32, with whomsoever thou findest thy gods, let him not live. Before our brethren, discern thou what is thine with me, and take it to thee. For Jacob knew not that Rachel had stolen them. Here was the ugly situation. When Rachel left, and remember they left in a hurry, they didn't even take the time to say goodbye, farewell. They left in a hurry, and she took the household gods with her. The images of those gods, the teraphim. So that was the truth. She had them. Now Jacob didn't know it. Rachel had not said to Jacob, by the way, I stole the gods from Laban's house. She didn't tell him that. And we don't even know exactly why she did it. Whether, as I suggested earlier, she was hedging the way. Well, if this worship of Jehovah doesn't work out, then we have these other gods on which we can rely. Or whether she thought they would be just nice mementos of her growing up years, sentimental tokens. But nevertheless, she had them. And the fact that she had them was an indication that in Jacob's household, there was still an attachment to the ways of the past. They represented something of the ongoing alliance with the old ways. And Jacob, however he came to know about it, understood that what was going on in his household was that false gods were being worshipped. And he said now, they have got to go. They have got to go. Here was revival breaking out in the household of Jacob, in the camp of the faithful. Part of the powerful effects of grace. Here was the message of Jacob. Put away the strange gods that are among you and be clean. And change your garments. Get rid of those things. That is, Jacob realized if they were going up to Bethel, there had to be a re-emphasis on the need for purity among the people of God. Now, idolatry is a constant source of problem for the people of God. Very interesting that a long time afterward, at the very same oak it appears, of which we read in verse 4, Jacob hid them under the oak which was by Shechem. That if we look through the years following to Joshua chapter 24, Joshua 24, I'm not going to take the time to read beginning at verse 14, but that's where the passage would begin, going through all through verse 26, where Joshua again urged the people. Now, here are the people after the age of the conquest. Joshua is ready to depart the scene himself. And he has to say again to the people, put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the flood and in Egypt. And he said it again in verse 23, put away the strange gods which are among you and incline your heart unto the Lord God of Israel. And the people said unto Joshua, the Lord our God will we serve, and his voice will we obey. So Joshua made a covenant, I'm in verse 25, with the people that day, and set them a statute and an ordinance in Shechem. And Joshua wrote these words in the book of the law of God, and took a great stone and set it up there under an oak that was by the sanctuary of the Lord. Here in this same place was now the sanctuary, the tabernacle that had been set up. Was it the same oak? We don't know, but it was certainly an oak in the same location. And there was the message to a subsequent generation. You're going to continue to go on with God. You're going to have to cut all the alliances to that which is past. Jacob was saying to his household, let's get away from this dalliance with that which is of the world. Let's commit ourselves afresh to the service of God. Josiah set an example in this regard as well. If we turn to 2 Chronicles chapter 34, 2 Chronicles chapter 34, and verse 3. Josiah became king when he was 8 years old. We read in verse 3, in the eighth year of his reign, while he was yet young. So now he's 15, maybe 16. He began to seek after the God of David his father. And in the 12th year, now he's 19, maybe 20, he began to purge Judah and Jerusalem from the high places, and the groves, and the carved images, and the molten images. And they break down the altars of Balaam in his presence, and the images that were on high above them he cut down. And the groves, and the carved images, and the molten images he break in pieces, and made dust of them, and strode it upon the graves of them that had sacrificed unto them. It would appear that every generation has to learn the lesson over. You cannot go back to those old ways and expect God to bless you. Jacob took all those gods. We read in verse 4 of Genesis 35, they gave unto Jacob all the strange gods which were in their hand, and all their earrings which were in their ears, which appeared to have some attachment to the method of worship of these false gods. And Jacob hid them under the oak which was by Shechem. That is, apparently he picked a place and buried all of this stuff and didn't tell anyone where it was, so that they couldn't go back and dig it all up again. What was the message? You're not going to be serving those anymore. You're not going to be serving those anymore. We are going up to Bethel. So this progress of sanctification is another one of the powerful effects of grace. Now,
I hope I don't have to go through the long list of applications we can make on the subject of idolatry in our own time. You don't have to have an image of a god to be engaged in idolatry. There are plenty of idols all around us. But the point is, if those things have your attention, if those things have your devotion and your affection, you cannot go up to Bethel, to the house of God. But that they did go up is evident now as we come to the third of these powerful effects of grace, worship's prostration. We come to verse 3, where Jacob said, "Let us arise and go up to Bethel, and I will make there an altar unto God." What was he saying? All of the worship in which they had been engaged in Shechem was half-hearted. It was just an external form. What they needed was to get back to the place where he had met God and where there was to be shed the blood of atonement. The blood of the atonement had to flow. Their worship had to be on the basis of that which God required, the blood of the sacrifice. They had gotten away from that. And I submit to you today that many of the Lord's people in their minds have gotten away from that foundational truth that our worship is not for the purpose of making ourselves feel a certain way. That's how worship's being sold today. That's why you see all the nonsense that you see in worship today. It's because it's all about making people have a certain feeling. So when they lay there, they can write about it on Facebook or wherever else they post things. It's because they aim at a certain experience. Jacob's message was, we need a place where we are humble, where we are prostrated in the dust, where we recognize our complete dependence on Jehovah himself. And the only place we find that is the place where the blood flows. It's the place of the cross. It's the place to which the Lord brings us again and again. It's the place where we behold the Lamb of God. If that is not at the heart of our worship, we worship in vain. What was Jacob's testimony here? When he had been there before? There was a long memory now, 30 years. When he had been there before, God had answered him. If God will be with me, and his testimony was God had been with him, God was going to bring him back now to that place. And his testimony was, as surely as the Lord had answered in the past, he would do so again for his people. When we come to dwell upon the mighty effects of grace in our own lives, what can we do in worship but to bow in reverence before the God of all the universe and to say, as we were singing earlier, "Come thou, almighty King, help us thy praise to sing." And the last of these powerful effects, divine protection. Verse 5. And they journeyed. It's nice that we have verse 5. Because they complied with what Jacob said. They got rid of it all. Somewhere back there in a place they didn't know, Jacob had buried all the stuff. Now, they took up their journey. They went on their way. And what do we read here? God caused his terror to fall on the people who were around them. What was Jacob concerned about in chapter 34? Everybody around us is going to look upon us as easy targets. They're going to attack us and they're going to obliterate us. He had been afraid of Esau. Never mind about Esau. Now he was concerned about all these other people. But now, here were people who had left the old ways behind. And they were going to the house of God. And what do we find here? God put his terror, his awe, his fear upon the people who were all around them. And they were afraid. They saw here, here are God's people. We're not going to mess with God's people. These are the servants of the Most High God. And it wasn't just a calculation that they made. They were genuinely afraid. They were afraid not because somehow Jacob's little band had amassed a huge number of weapons that they could deploy. They were afraid because God made them afraid. This is the powerful effect of grace. I think we could do with some of this today. What do we see around us today? The enemies of the truth are not afraid of those who profess to believe the truth. They're not afraid. What is needed is for the Lord's people to leave behind the old ways, to devote themselves to getting to Bethel, to the house of God, to standing on the blood of the sacrifice. Because then God will make the enemies of the truth to be afraid of those who are walking in the will of God. My, what a glorious way in which to follow the darkness of chapter 34. Here's God's mercy. He doesn't leave his people in the awful depths of despair. He leaves them. He brings them to the heights of the house of God. May God so speak in our midst that he calls us to make our stand at Bethel, the place of the mediator, the place of the Messiah. And so we learn what it is truly to be with him and to know his power and to know his protection.